Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today recently received a long-awaited presidential pardon. The story of how Stephen Arrington came to be eligible for a presidential pardon is told in his autobiography, Extreme, Living in the Intensity of the Moment. Later in the hour, I'll be asking Steve what has happened since he wrote that book, but first I'll let him tell how he came to be an ex-convict living in Paradise, California. This interview first aired in 2011. Stephen Arrington, welcome.
Nancy, it is an absolute pleasure to be here today.
You know, your book is 461 pages, and I had a feeling that you could have gone on a lot longer because there were a lot of details you probably left out.
I did leave a lot out, and the name of the book, Extreme, is a bit pretentious. And so I really had to show why I was using that title, because there's so many extremes that are occurring, from being a felon and being in prison to being caught up with the Medellin drug cartel, to diving with Jacques Cousteau, to working with youth today to help them with their choices.
Yeah, it really is an amazing life that you would be, and when you're reading, as a reader, and you're reading your book, you think, oh my gosh, how can he ever, his life is spiraling downward. How can he ever turn things around? And somehow you did.
Well, I realized that the faults were my own, and I needed to give them away. I needed to get rid of them. And realizing that it was all my mistake meant that, for me, prison could suddenly become a place to learn and to grow, and that I needed to share in that experience. And so it was an institution of becoming a better person.
Well, I'll have to tell you that the part in prison was, because some of your life was a dream. I mean, you're living in Hawaii, you had a dream life. And then when you get in prison, I have to tell you, I had nightmares
<Me too. laughs>
when I was reading that section. But it has your story does have a happy ending. But let's go back to when you, as a young man, you joined the Navy, and you went to bomb disposal school.
Well, I went in the Navy because I wanted to do good things. I wanted to help people. And a bomb disposal person saves lives. You keep people from being hurt. And so I went through a school called Naval Explosive Ordnance Disposal School, where we learned how to defuse and disarm nuclear, biological, and conventional weapons. And that school was a fascinating place for a year. It was like every young person's dream to be involved in all this complex learning about explosives and bombs and diving. And I absolutely loved it. I thrived.
But you know what I found interesting was your instructor, and you call him McNair, and I don't know if that was a real name of one of your instructors, but he was a real philosopher.
He was amazing. In order to be somebody who teaches people how to disarm bombs and to serve in a war zone, you have to have a heightened state of awareness. And he's not just training people to graduate from school. He's training people who he may be working with. I might wind up on his team. And if you make a mistake, in bomb disposal, this is what we say, is initial success or spectacular failure.
Well, what did he tell you about heightened awareness?
Well,
why don't you read that section in your book?
All right. McNair is reacting to, I just blew up my whole team in practice, I've blown up my whole team. And we're talking about the environment. And I'll just reply what I wrote. Want me to hurt you? Replies McNair. I'm not talking about being a tree hugger. This is about being in a continuous state of heightened awareness. You need to make a major shift in the way you think. Your brain has to be in tune with your immediate global world. This way, if something is out of place, you notice it right away. What you are doing doesn't matter if you're in a war zone or in your mom's backyard eating barbecue. This is not just about being a warrior. It's about being an aware, alert human being. It means being the one to notice the accident that is about to happen and getting out of its way, or better yet, moving others out of the way. It is about perceiving the dark shape shadowing you in the darkness and knowing how to escape or confront and kill it. It is about caring to learn new skills that will enhance your ability to solve problems. It is about being more than just another common moron crawling about on this fascinating planet.
And you're listening to Steve Arrington. He's reading from his autobiography, Extreme, and telling us about one of his instructors in the bomb disposal school he attended when he was in the Navy. And this is exciting because I think anybody who joins the Navy would be one of their first choices, I would think, to be a Navy frogman.
Well, most people want to get into the spec warfare command. Tens of thousands have that dream. A couple thousand apply. A few hundred are really deeply considered. 30 to 50 make it to school. We graduated six.
Six. Yeah, because one mistake in a situation like that is fatal, not just to the person making the mistake, but to his team. So they were very selective. So you were really among a very chosen few.
I was so blessed to have had, I worked so hard for that opportunity, and that's where it's kind of amazing to think that I threw it away.
Well, let's go to how you threw it away then, because you were in the Navy about 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get out of the Navy, you were kind of at loose ends. You wanted to study photojournalism.
Yes,
so
I did.
You went to school because you had the GI Bill. You thought, okay, here's an opportunity. But you really weren't that committed as a student.
No, what happened? Well, I was addicted to marijuana.
That's unfortunate.
It is. And a lot of people think marijuana is an addictive. For me, it was addictive. It was an instant change of your attitude. And that's what ended my military career. I got caught with marijuana. I sold some to another sailor. In a 14-year career, I flushed on a toilet. And I got out. I wanted to get my life back together. I was going to college. But I was still addicted to marijuana, and so I wasn't learning much.
Well, did you remember from any of your courses when you were writing your book? You were able to draw on those classes you took in photojournalism?
Not in the photojournalism part, except for the one thing that I always remembered from this one class I took in English is the professor asked me why I was taking this English class. And I said, well, one day I would like to be a writer. And he looked at me and he laughed and he said, Mr. Arrington, trust me, I've graded your homework. You will never be a writer. So I tell young people today, don't let anybody interfere with your dreams or your dreams. And you need to work towards making those dreams come true because nobody's going to give them to you.
Well, I think that's just one of an instance where people underestimated you. You think so?
Well, you know, I think that all of us have this capability of phenomenal achievement. There's a saying, if opportunity knocks, open the door. I don't like that opportunity because it assumes you can wait at home for it to come to you. I think we need to go out on the street, hunt opportunity down, wrestle it, and say, I'm not going to let you go until you help me.
So you're out of the Navy. You're working in this dive shop and surfer. You're a surfer guy after you get out and taking some classes. And then this guy comes along and says, boy, Steve, you know, I can make you vice president of my company. And he made you so many promises. I'll pay you a zillion times more than you're getting paid to be to a clerk in a surf shop. And so you said, well, okay, I'm in for that. Yeah. And boy, did that take you on a trip you never expected.
Well, he was a man who had been in my past. I'd known him 7 years earlier, and I knew him as a multimillionaire in the aviation business. And he treated me like a son. And I come from a broken family, and so having a father figure was important. And now, 7 years later, he suddenly calls me on the telephone. I'm going to college. I'm working part-time at a surf shop for minimum wage. And he offers me this incredible flying position. I was a private pilot. But what I did.
So besides being a diver, you're also a pilot.
Well, I invested in adventure. And that's, see, Nancy, you just touched on something really critical, is I was an achiever until I got caught up with marijuana. Marijuana stole my motivation. It stole my dreams. It stole my career. It almost ended my life. And this man hires me as a pilot because I knew I made the marijuana mistake. I went to work for him. I saw that he was corrupt.
Because this was bait and switch. She said, here, Steve, I'm offering you this big salary. I'm going to make you vice president of my company. And then you find out, no, you're just a gopher.
I'm just a gopher. And then he reveals that he's a cocaine transporter. And under threat of guns, they tell me either it's silver or lead. Get in the airplane and take a bullet in the head.
And so he wanted you because you could fly. And where did he want you to fly?
Columbia.
Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So that was scary. Oh, boy, you had to read her on pins and needles when you were in Columbia.
Well, landing in Colombia, I get out of an airplane surrounded by men with guns, and they're calling me amigo and things like that. And what really got me, Nancy, is I realized these are the bad guys, and they consider me on their side. And I was now caught up in a life that I didn't know how to get out without getting killed. And I was scared to death, and I thought I was a macho guy. But I realized that my moral compass was spinning. I wasn't focused. My character wasn't there. I was in big trouble.
So you're in Florida, and your boss, who you thought was a friend,
mm-hmm.
says, Steve, I've got this little job I want you to do. I want you to drive this car to California.
And I find out that the car is loaded with cocaine, and I want to run. I was looking for a plan to escape. And he told me that if I drove the car, he was going to give me some money. He hadn't given me any money yet. He was going to give me some money and let me take a vacation.
Yeah, he keeps promising you he's going to pay you.
Oh, he's working me so well. He's working me so well. And so I agree to drive this car across the United States. It had $27 million of the cocaine in it. And as I'm driving the car across the United States, literally October the 14th, 5:05 p.m., I turn on the radio and Ronald Reagan, the president of the United States, is announcing his war on drugs. And he had been my commander chief, and I'm driving a car full of drugs. And I realize it's only going to get worse. I've got to get out. And so instead of delivering that car, I abandoned it.
With millions of dollars worth of cocaine in it. So now you've got everybody is against you.
it's just so scary. I called him up on the telephone, my boss. I told him I quit, that I didn't want anything else to do with the car. He had men with guns take me back to the car. I thought they were going to kill me. Then I see a dozen more men come running out of the darkness. I didn't know it, but they're DEA agents, and I'm arrested. And Nancy, what really got me is they had me slammed up against the side of a black shiny van, and I can see my reflection. I can see a dozen men with guns, and was flooding through my heart and soul as relief. I wasn't arrested. I was literally saved.
I'm talking to Stephen Arrington about his book, Extreme. He was a Navy frogman, and when he got out of the Navy, discovered he was smuggling cocaine. He didn't know he was doing that. So you're arrested, and the next thing you know, you're on the front page of the L.A. Times with your co-defendant, who turned out to be somebody very famous.
John DeLorean.
John DeLorean.
I had no idea. I knew about the DeLorean automobile. I wasn't informed about things like this. But it was called the drug trial of the century. My mom finds out I've been arrested on television. And there's something else that I discovered very quickly with this, is that as I'm in prison, and it's on the news every day, is I became what's called a celebrity inmate. And other inmates want to be your friend. They want to associate with you. And I'm finding myself with people who are murderers and bank robbers, and they want to be my friend, smugglers. And I'm in a very, very scary world, and it's like everything's crazy.
In fact, they intentionally made it as scary as possible because they wanted you to talk. So they put you in a cell with this huge guy, this inmate, this big black guy who they thought would scare you into thinking, oh, my gosh, I better tell what I know. But you didn't know anything.
I didn't know anything. And, yeah, they called him the scariest guy at TI, and TI is for Terminal Island Prison. And we were in the hole, and the hole's where you go to be disciplined. And what's interesting is the guy I worked for, Morgan Hetrick, and John DeLorean are in a nicer jail unit. I'm in the hole with the scariest guy at TI, and what they're really looking to do is to scare me into full cooperation.
And you refused to do that?
I refused to do it because there was a young man who rode with me in the car, and I wanted to protect him. And the other thing is I was trying to wrap my mind around what had just happened to me, and that people had taken control of my life. And I knew that if I started cooperating, that they would use me in other cases, and suddenly I'd be in that world. And they didn't need my cooperation. You mentioned the word earlier, I was a gopher.
Yeah.
Gopher this, gopher that.
Well, and even at your sentencing, I thought it was very interesting. The judge, who later turned out to be quite a friend of yours, the judge in your trial, the judge that sentenced you, and I thought it was so interesting that the questions that he asked the prosecutor and then what your defense attorney said. Why don't you go to that part of your book where the judge asked some questions of the prosecutor?
Judge Takatsuki asks, Mr. Prosecutor, do you have any evidence that Mr. Arrington knew anything about this drug scheme before he took possession of the car or that he was involved in the supposed conspiracy with Hetrick and DeLorean. No, answers the prosecutor. The judge continues, do you believe that Mr. Arrington has any money off of this or any other crime, and is there any possibility that he may have hidden any money away? The prosecutor looks unhappy. No, with Hetrick cooperating, we have complete access to all the appropriate bank records. You may sit down, says the judge.
So he just shows that you didn't know that the car had cocaine in it, and you didn't profit from it. You got not one red cent out of this deal.
Well, I didn't know there was cocaine in the car until they put me in it with guns.
Yeah.
but what's really interesting here is, as you mentioned this, is that Judge Takasugi and I, after the sentencing, after prison, we become friends, and the prosecutor who wanted me to get 45 years to life in prison wrote the introduction to the book.
So at one point at your sentencing, he's saying, throw the book at this guy, practically. Mm-hmm. And yet, when you write your book, the foreword is written by the very man who prosecuted you in that trial.
James Walsh, Jr., U.S. District Attorney.
He came to be an admirer of yours.
Wow. You know, I mean, when you say the word admirer, my ego has a little bit of trouble with that. We became friends. And that was amazing because there's a lot of psychology going on when somebody who's been a victim in some way, I was a victim, but the only reason I'm sharing this is because the prosecutor is trying to really give me a serious sentence. Sometimes you get like a relationship going on with that person, but we became friends, and that was amazing. And when I say the word victim, I set myself up. It's my fault I went to prison. I deserved it.
Well, you know, when your defense attorney speaks, then after the prosecutor has to admit that, no, he didn't get any money out of this deal, he doesn't have any money hidden anywhere that he's going to get. And then I like the section where your defense attorney gives a recap of your life of service up until this point that you had made this bad decision. Read that section for us, Steve.
My defense attorney, Richard Barnett, then stands up. He references my long list of community service. He notes that I have been a volunteer CPR and first aid instructor for the Red Cross for over 15 years. He talks about my 14-year military career, during which I made 4 tours to Vietnam. He tells I had risked my life as a bomb disposal frogman while engaged in dangerous missions for the Navy, the Secret Service, and the CIA. He points out that I resisted involvement in Morgan's criminal enterprise and that Morgan resorted to gross manipulations to force my cooperation.
I'm listening to, and we are, Steve Arrington reading from his autobiography, Extreme. And he is telling us what happened at his sentencing, what the prosecutor said, what the defense attorney said. And then, Steve, when it came your turn to speak, read us that section. What did you tell the judge?
The greatest words I have ever heard were, federal agents, you're under arrest.
Now, that's a shocking statement, I think, for most people. The greatest words I ever heard was, you're under arrest.
Nancy, what it was like is, first, these guys are going to kill me. I've abandoned a car with $27 million of the cocaine.
You're a dead man.
They're going to kill me. And now I think another gang has come in, and then I discover they're not a gang. They're DEA agents. They're not going to kill me. They're taking me to prison. Nancy, it was like being pioneers with the wagons. And suddenly having, you know, the Indians.
The cavalry right over the hill.
The Indians got you surrounded, and then here comes the cavalry with the flag and the bugle.
That's the image I thought of, too. I really did.
Really? I was saved. I was saved.
Yeah. So what else did you say in your defense? Or you really weren't trying to defend your actions?
No, I wasn't. When they arrested me, these words freed me. The greatest words I've ever heard were, federal agents, you're under arrest. Those words freed me from a nightmare. I had been living a life of deceit. I did things I was afraid not to do. When Agent Scotty arrested me, he later said, well, I guess this isn't the best day in your life. I replied, actually, I think it is.
The best day of your life, because then you knew you weren't going to be killed. At least outside the prison walls. Now, when you got in prison, that was also...
Well, it was twofold. Not only was I not going to be killed, is suddenly... I felt free because the Medellin drug cartel and Morgan Hetrick had control of my life up to that moment. And suddenly, I'm free of all that. I'm a free man who's heading for prison.
Yeah, the irony of that you, on the day of your arrest, you are really set free.
Yes.
From the demons that were pursuing you.
Later on, I write in the book that I was happier in prison than when I was living a multimillionaire lifestyle with Morgan Hetrick, and it was deceit and corruption. In prison, I recaptured who I was.
And you're stripped of everything, of course, and they put you in the worst part of the prison they could because they wanted you to cooperate. But you kept showing that you were a good prisoner, and you kept getting more privileges and moved to a little better circumstances.
You know, I was blessed. God was really watching over me. They put me in with the scariest inmate in the whole world, and this was a very lonely man. And being the scariest guy at the prison, he didn't have friends. And so in his own way, he reached out to me. Now, he's a very violent man, but we became friends as much as two inmates, one white, one black, because there's racial issues, as much as you could be. And it was an amazing wake-up call for me.
Steve Arrington is my guest, and his book is Extreme. And he is telling us about why he went to prison as a drug smuggler and what prison was like. You tell us that you had a lot to learn about being a prisoner because you didn't know all the different ins and outs.
Nobody does. When you go to prison, and nobody is realizing that their life is going to head them in that direction, but if it does, if somebody winds up in prison, the guards will give you a set of rules that are written down. And if you violate those, you get in trouble. But the inmate rules are not written down except for maybe as graffiti on the wall, and you violate those, not only may they kill you, but they're going to humiliate you and punish you before they kill you.
So you have to contend with these unwritten rules that you don't even know about, that the prisoners are living their lives by. But gradually you get more privileges, you get moved. And part of that time, though, too, Steve, you were living really close to where you had spent wonderful days as a Navy frogman, just a stone's throw. There you were imprisoned on this island within sight of where you used to have this wonderful experience as a Navy frogman.
Yeah, I could literally see Long Beach Naval Station, and I had sailed to Vietnam from those very piers. And it really reminded me of what I had given up.
Well, I want to move to now where you're getting more in privileges, and they decided, well, this guy doesn't need to be locked up. We can take him to a camp out in the desert. And when you get there, there is a fire team there. And you have experience as a fireman. And so it's a wonderful scene when you go in to talk to the unit manager, because everybody, when you get there, you get assignments. You can be a plumber. And so you request being a fireman. And tell us, when you walked into the unit manager's office, and nobody likes this guy. I don't know if you knew it when you first walked in, but nobody likes this unit manager. I mean, so what did you tell him to convince him that he ought to give you that duty as a fireman?
Well, the unit manager he hated inmates. And he told me that I could not become a fireman because that was the honor roll. And when I left his office, I went to see the safety officer who's in charge of the fire department. And I went in, and without reading from the book itself, because I know we're getting short on time, what I told the unit manager, the safety officers, I said, "Sir, I want to be a good person. I deserve to be in prison. I want to turn my life around. I want to do good things. And that's the focus of my life. And there's nothing I could do in prison that would be of more service than being an inmate fireman. And I want to be a fireman more than anything. And I'll be the first one here, the last one to leave. I'll keep a smile on my face. I'll polish the truck. I'll work as hard as I possibly can." And he gave me a chance, and he made me an inmate fireman. And 3 months later, I became chief engineer of Boron Inmate Fire Crew. And I have our listeners right now, have you ever heard of an inmate driving a vehicle? I got to drive a full-size fire truck. I got to leave the prison 17 times. I got to lead the response with a prison guard along. But I got to leave prison driving a fire truck, red light and siren, all the excitement of a prison escape.
I mean, this is the things that little boys dream about. What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a fireman.
And I got it. And what was so important to me about being an inmate fireman is that as an inmate, somebody who had been locked away from society, I got to put on the uniform of a hero, a firefighter, and I got to save lives.
And you literally did.
We literally did. In fact, we responded also to the crash of the B-1 bomber, the second prototype of that aircraft ever made, the most advanced aircraft in the American inventory. And the first ones on the scene were inmates in a really old fire truck. but we save lives.
My guest is Stephen Arrington. He is telling us about life as he has been in prison for drug smuggling. His book, his autobiography is Extreme. And when he was a fireman, you and your team did such an outstanding job that you attracted the attention of congressmen. And they wanted to come down to this camp in the desert and see how did you do this? How are you doing so well? But meanwhile, when the warden is all set to show the congressman what a wonderful fire team he has, they had replaced you and your team so that when the congressman arrived to see this demonstration of this fantastic fire team, they didn't see your team.
No, what happened? Well, we came to their attention because we saved the crew of the B-1 bomber. This was huge. And so when they, in conjunction with that, I talked to a newspaper, and the unit manager hated me, got excited, and he pulled me off the fire crew. And then we had two doctors who were in for insurance fraud, and they were on, and he pulled them off the fire crew. And then one guy got out, and so now they have a new fire crew, and the truck was temperamental. And so to impress the congressman, they set a trash can on fire. And the fire truck comes, but the new engineer didn't know how to prime the pump. And so the fire goes out, and the only thing that was burning at that point was the warden's temper.
You can just imagine. This is a classic scene out of a movie, Steve, that here the congressman, the dignitaries come down and want to see a demonstration of this wonderful fire team that had rescued the B-1 bomber that crashed. But it's a different team. You aren't there, and the people on your team aren't there, and the warden ends up being embarrassed in front of the congressman because this incompetent team.
What a moment in time. I'll never forget it.
So then they call you back in and say, you know, they're begging you, Steve, we need you back on the fire team.
Well, they didn't beg. They ordered. And I was glad to do it because, again, a chance to be able to help people. And now I was helping myself, helping others. Benjamin Franklin said, when you do good for others, you're doing the best for yourself.
And then your life even takes a more amazing turn when you get out and you find out that Jacques Cousteau, his son, Jean-Michel Cousteau, they want you on their team as a diver to lead their diving expeditions. And you got to do research on great white sharks.
Well, they invited me to join the Cousteau Society as an expedition leader. And the reason why, Nancy, is I was speaking at schools to kids about going for their dreams. And I'm telling kids, go for your dreams. And Jean-Michel heard about me encouraging kids to go for their dreams. And he gave me my childhood dream. And for 5.5 years, I got a tour of the world diving with great white sharks, whales, and dolphins, even swim with lava underwater. It was the adventure of a lifetime. And the prosecutor argued to get me off parole so that I could travel with the Cousteaus.
With the Cousteau Society. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Steve. And you now, I mentioned, you're a lay youth minister, and you have and you speak to high schools and schools about drug education. The book is Extreme, on Living in the Intensity of the Moment. Thank you, Steve.
A pleasure, Nancy. Thank you.
That interview with Stephen Arrington is from March 2011. After a break, I will ask Steve what has happened in the past 6 years since that first interview. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is former convict turned crusader Stephen Arrington, whose 2011 interview told the story of how he became eligible for a presidential pardon. Stephen Arrington, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here, Nancy.
A couple of weeks ago, I was thinking about you and your pardon, because I know you'd been waiting a long time, and it was the last few days of President Obama's administration, and I was just sure you were finally going to get that pardon. Why did it take so long?
Because my case was called the drug trial of the century, and there were some emails that were leaked, and President Obama requested that no high-profile drug dealer came across his desk. And so he waited until 2 days left in his administration. And when they called, I was absolutely stunned, and I cried. And I thought, as a macho guy, I just bawled. My wife, Cindy, just hugged me, because I waited 9 years for that pardon. And Nancy, what's important is, because of marijuana, I fell from the rank of heroes. Now, when I say that, I'm not being self-serving. I was a bomb disposal frogman. The longest walk in the world is walking in on an unexploded bomb. I have done that. And it was important to me. And so I fell from that. And then I got caught up in the DeLorean case. And that was under threat of a gun. But the bottom line is, I did it. And I deserved my incarceration. I did 31 and a half months, and I deserved every day of it.
So President Obama could not pardon some high-profile drug dealer, and you can't get much higher profile than having your picture on the front page of the LA Times with John DeLorean.
It was amazing to be what they call a celebrity inmate. It was on the news all the time. It was bigger than the O.J. Simpson trial. It was huge. And I knew that under the spotlight that I was probably getting a very serious sentence, because I refused to cooperate. And the only reason I refused to cooperate is I didn't need to hurt anybody else. I had a time to serve of incarceration, and I was prepared to do that.
And they wanted you to rat out the others.
They didn't really need me. That's the part. You see, the man I worked for, Morgan Hetrick, who I thought was a legitimate businessman, and he was a cocaine transporter. I didn't know he was a coke guy until it was too late, when the guns came out. And I was ordered to co-pilot a plane to Colombia and drive a car from Florida to California. I didn't want to do either of those things, but I did them. And so why should I put it off on somebody else? I deserve to be punished. And there was nothing I could tell the government didn't already know. But the reason why they wanted me so bad is I was going to go to trial first. John DeLorean and I, we merged our defenses. And I'm going to go before the judge first, and they're going to have a chance to hear everything that the prosecution witnesses have to say before DeLorean goes up. So they thought if they could get me to cooperate, then they might be able to get John DeLorean to plead guilty.
And was he guilty?
He wasn't not guilty of a drug crime. That is the most important aspect here. People ask me, was he guilty? Well, I don't know what he was like as a businessman, but I do know what happened in this case. And not only do I know what happened in this case, John DeLorean and I, we merged our defenses. And so I have all the files. Now, when I say I have the files, there was the press was really after the transcripts of the secret tapes. I have those. I have the court exhibits by the FBI. I have the FBI investigative reports. I have John DeLorean's investigative reports. I have all the evidence. And it shows 100% that John DeLorean was set up by the government, that the government broke the chain of evidence by destroying evidence, that they lied, and that they threatened him. And I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but laws were broken by government agents, including breaking into houses and getting caught. Now, when you're a federal agent and the police come and everything else, and he shows his badge, and his name's Gerald Scotti, and he's the number lead investigator in the John DeLorean case, that's not a good thing. So this case, it goes much higher than people know. You want to know where it begins, Nancy?
Yes, I do. Let me remind people that I'm talking to Stephen Arrington, whose autobiography we heard in the first half hour of the show. And the title of his autobiography was Extreme. And he told what he was able to tell at that time in his first book. He told the story of what he was able to tell at the time. Now, Steve, you're telling us things that you could not say in that first book. Is that right?
Well, the first book, I was telling my autobiography. This is different. People have been asking me, you know the conspiracy, you know everything, tell the story. And what worried me is if I told the whole story, that might influence whether I got a presidential pardon or not. But I decided it needed to be told. And so the John DeLorean drug trial begins with Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady of England. And the reason why is in Ireland, they were having big problems. The Republican Army was blowing people up, shooting people. It was a war, and they needed jobs. And John DeLorean started an automobile company there. From when they first started, it took 2 years to drive the first car off the line. That's amazing. The government of England helped, about £138 million to get the company going, and other money came in. And then £18 million went missing. And there was three individuals who had some involvement, and one of them was John DeLorean. And one man went to prison. One man had a heart attack and died. And John DeLorean was living in the United States and was not going back over to England, and Margaret Thatcher couldn't get him. And Margaret Thatcher had another problem. It was called the Falkland War. 127 ships, 26,000 soldiers. She could have lost that war, and Ronnie Reagan, she thought would help her, but she didn't get the help she wanted. And that was a scar on their relationship. And they had a meeting before the John DeLorean drug trial got started. We don't know what was said behind those in that room. But Edwin Meese directed all these government agencies to go after John DeLorean. But the problem is the government had nothing. They're trying to get him. They can't get him. And there was a con man by the name of James Timothy Hoffman who had smuggled cocaine and marijuana up from Central America to California. He got caught. He became government witness. And he's still a con man. And he wants to get paid. He wants to make money. So he's trying to develop cases. And he sees that they are after John DeLorean. And he says, well, John DeLorean was my neighbor. Well, that's not exactly true. They lived in the same town. And he says, I know him. Well, he met him once because his son, Hoffman's son and DeLorean's son, went dirt biking for an afternoon. And that was it. And so he says, I can deliver. He says to Gerald Scotty, he says, I can deliver John DeLorean. So he went after John DeLorean. And they had a meeting. He called John DeLorean up and he says, look, I see in the Wall Street Journal that you need money. He says, I have access to big time money. I can get you $60 million. And so John DeLorean, he needs $60 million to save his company. So he agrees to meet with him. And supposedly this meeting was not recorded, but this was specifically set up to record that, you know, to get John DeLorean on tape. And when he said, I'll get you $60 million, he says to John DeLorean, but I want a finder's fee. If I get you the $60 million, I want $1.8 million. Then he goes back to his FBI handlers and he says, John DeLorean wants to invest $1.8 million to get $50 to $60 million back selling heroin from Indonesia.
Which was a total lie.
Which was a total lie. But you see, James Hoffman, the con man, is the one who ran this case. Because he's telling one thing to the FBI, another thing to John DeLorean. And he builds this whole case. And then he tells John DeLorean, well, the money's coming from people in Colombia. And John DeLorean goes, uh-oh, I'm not sure I want to be a part of this. And then Hoffman reveals, well, they're actually cocaine smugglers. And they have all this money and they need to invest it. And John DeLorean says, I want out. I don't want anything to do with this. And Hoffman says, you know too much. They'll kill your kids. And that scared John DeLorean to death. And he didn't know how to get out. And you see, I really understood what he had to deal with because—
You were in a similar situation.
Exactly.
You couldn't get out.
Nancy, to be 100% honest on this, I thought I was a macho guy. I was a bomb disposal frogman. I worked with frog teams. And when I was with the teams, it was no man left behind. You had courage because you had purpose and you had people standing behind you. When I got caught up with the Medellin drug cartel— Those scary people, I didn't know how to get out. They're going to kill me. They've told me they're going to kill me. They'll kill my family. If you upset them, they'll come in your house. They'll kill everybody in your house. If you have a goldfish, they'll kill it. They'll kill your dog, make you watch all of it. And then they'll torture and kill you.
And that's what John DeLorean was up against.
And that's what John DeLorean
and
was up against.
And you understood being in that situation, being in his shoes.
Exactly. And so they threatened him. And he also got threatened by a DEA agent. Remember, I have the files. I have the evidence. He got threatened, and he didn't know how to get out. He's trying to get out. He couldn't get out. And so now he's having to go along with it. And a long story short, because we could do hours on this, is that when DeLorean was supposed to put up $1.8 million, he said, I don't have it. He said the Irish Republican Army was putting up the $1.8 million, and they don't have it, and I had to give the $1.8 million I had to the receiver, and the money's gone. And so they said, you mean the deal's dead? And he says, yeah, the deal's dead. And the agent was mad. And he says, well, what are we going to do? And he says, well, unless you have some other ideas. Well, they had some other ideas. They wanted him to put 40 DeLoreans up as collateral. For $1.8 million, 40 DeLoreans, math doesn't work. But they wanted some collateral.
Automobiles now, you might add.
Yeah.
When you say DeLoreans.
Yeah, yeah, DeLoreans.
So His car.
Back to the Future car.
Yes.
And so what he did is he made a shell company. DeLorean Motor Company is what was building the DeLorean motor car. DeLorean Motor Car Company was an empty shell that he made up, and it was worth nothing. Now, everybody knows it's worth nothing, but he tells them that he's going to give them half of DeLorean Motor Car Company, and they're going to give him $50 to $60 million for that. And when the jury heard that, they're just going, no way are we going to buy this. This doesn't work. And the agent actually admitted before Wiseman, the lead attorney, that that was the actual plan. And it's foolish. You don't turn $2 million, $1.8 million worth of cocaine into $50 or $60 million in 1 week. It's impossible.
My guest is Stephen Arrington, and his autobiography was entitled Extreme, and he told his own story in that book. He has a second book entitled In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant. So since you're the only one that can really tell this story, you came out with another book and telling more of what you could not tell in your previous book.
And more of what I was afraid to tell, because I really wanted a presidential pardon. And they were trying so hard to get me to cooperate. The man I worked for, Morgan Hetrick, he cooperated. He agreed to turn evidence and everything. And they couldn't get me to cooperate. And so they sent a federal agent to scare me. And he did. He did a great job scaring me, but I still didn't cooperate. So they sent Morgan Hetrick into my cell block for a week after he's already given all of his evidence, and he's trying to get me to cooperate, and I won't. And he told me, he said, Steve, he said, I really feel sorry about what I've done to you. So I'm going to tell you the things that you need, everything I can to help you with your defense. And I said to him, I said, you know, Morgan, I was working at a surf shop, and I was happy. I was going broke, but I was happy. And you came in and you ruined my life and you offered me this incredible job. You're going to pay me $50,000 a year 35 years ago. You're going to pay me $50,000 a year. You said you're going to double it every 6 months and I was going to become an executive vice president of your company. So you're going to turn your business over to me. I said, why did you have to tell me that? He said, Steve, I was going to turn my business over to you. I said, are you talking about the cocaine business? He said, what other type of business was I in? I go, what do you mean you're going to turn it over to me? He said, Steve, you're a Navy frog. He says, you know all these guys who
Plus
are...
Plus you're a pilot.
I'm a pilot, but I know all these guys who are commandos. He says, the thing about the cartels, they're employing Colombians who didn't graduate from middle school, and they're all emotions, and they do stupid things. He says, we can get all this high-tech equipment. We could have run this big operation. And I'm going, I never would have brought my people in. And you know what, Nancy? I'm a lousy criminal. I want to be a good guy, not a bad guy. But Pablo Escobar was going to put up a couple million dollars. They wanted to get airplanes and build a network around me. I didn't know any of this. And so if I revealed that, my chances of my pardon, you know, are going out the door. I decided to reveal it over about a year ago. I wrote the whole story. If I didn't get my pardon, then I didn't get my pardon. I wanted to tell the story of what happened between DeLorean, Hetrick, and I, and these agents who lied in court, who falsified evidence, who broke the law in their attempt to get an innocent man. And when I say an innocent man, John DeLorean was innocent of any drug dealing whatsoever. I prove it in the book. You read the book, it's there. And I have all the files, and I'm doing a lot of bigot time interviews, and people are seeing these files right now.
Now, is there a movie being made? Because this seems like it's definitely movie material.
There's actually two. It looks like two are being made. One of them is by XYZ Films. Right now, the working title is DeLorean. And I interviewed with them 2 weeks ago. I showed them all my files. I showed them the exhibits. They can see it. I'll give you an idea. On Exhibit B, Item 15, it says that they interviewed John DeLorean early in the month of July, but they didn't record it because it was a social event. Well, the social event was their snitch bringing John DeLorean into a bar to try to get him involved in a drug deal. That's not a social event. And then the next meeting was the 15th of July. And at that meeting, John DeLorean is being introduced to a supposedly dirty banker who's really an undercover FBI agent. And they said they didn't record that one because John DeLorean was not yet a target by the DEA. Well, I have a transcript of a tape from July the 2nd where DeLorean is talking to that same banker. And so they provided as evidence to the court false information when evidence was there to prove it. And Wiseman found it, and he went after it.
Now explain who Wiseman is.
Wiseman was the lead attorney. He and Ray were the attorneys for John DeLorean, defense attorneys.
And this, what you're telling us now, you recount in your more recent book, In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant. So you knew what really went on. And it is kind of amazing that you were so strong when you were up against all these powerful people, because when you were younger, you made some bad choices, Steve. I hate to say it, but you did.
Well, I grew up in a broken family. I didn't have a father teach me about my moral compass and everything. I thought the whole world was all about Steve Arrington. And so that's the way I lived my life, as a bomb disposal frogman and everything.
Because that's a very elite group. They don't just let anybody who wants to be a frogman be one. It's very selective.
Well, in our bomb disposal class, about 1,000 people seriously applied. 32 of us were accepted, and 6 of us graduated. And it was $1 million education back in 35 years ago. And so it was a big deal. And that's what I forfeited because of marijuana. And that's what led to this whole thing with the DeLorean case.
Because you had a very nice career in the Navy, 14 years
14,
in the Navy.
14 years working with the Secret Service, protecting foreign heads of state, top secret military operations, recovery of reentry vehicles from space, phenomenal diving. It was all adventure, and I threw it away because of marijuana was illegal. Okay? Now, it's changing now, but 2 ounces of marijuana is what ruined my career. But I'm the one who did it. I always want people to know, I did it. No excuse.
And when it came to pleading guilty, you did because you say, I was guilty.
What I agreed was to testify against myself. Not somebody else, just against myself. I told the judge what I did. He could have given me 30 years. When I was first arrested, I was facing 145 years to life. Because of the amount of cocaine involved. I had co-piloted a plane with 650 pounds of cocaine on board. I drove the car with coke for DeLorean, which is another 55 pounds. And then supposedly the conspiracy that DeLorean was involved in involved 200 kilos of cocaine. So we're talking over 1,250 pounds of coke as a conspiracy. So I was charged with conspiracy of 1,250 pounds of cocaine and intent to distribute 730 pounds of cocaine. So when I went before the judge, he could have given me 30 years. Those were huge numbers. The prosecutor says, we don't see people with numbers this high. You know, we deserve a serious incarceration. The judge gave me 5 because he knew that I resisted every step of the way. But I certainly didn't resist well enough because I did it.
Yeah.
So I deserved my incarceration.
But you did not end up serving 5 years because you were really a model inmate. You were a hero, really. You were a hero during your time as an inmate.
What's phenomenal is I made a commitment of faith a few months after I was arrested, and it was a strong commitment, and it's stronger now. And that was is that I was going to do good with the rest of my life, and I became an honor inmate, and I got transferred to Boron Prison Camp where they had a fire crew that responded to automobile accidents and fires because nobody else was close enough to save the lives. The inmates voted me chief engineer, and I got to leave the prison 17 times, red light and siren, driving a fire truck. But then a B-1A supersonic bomber crashes 6 miles from the camp. I got to lead that response. Nancy, what was incredible is I put on the uniform of a hero, a firefighter. That was a perfect gift tailored to me by God. And then a military aircraft with all types of hazards, explosive hazards, that was my expertise. When I was in charge of Team 11, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, we worked on aircraft carriers and military aircraft. And so I was exactly where I needed to be. And so I knew when I put on that firefighting jacket, I had to become a man of meaning and purpose and be willing to put my life on the line to save another firefighter or to save a victim.
Well, then at another time you saved a young man, was lucky you were there. You saved a young man from drowning. You actually got a certificate of merit signed by President Ronald Reagan,
who was my hero and who as a kid. And so when I got that certificate, I knew right then and there that if God could use me to physically save the life of this kid who he was effectively dead, underwater without air for 8.5 minutes, you don't normally live, but he is at depth in cold water, and they think that's what made him last. But when that happened, I knew that I could use my breath to help kids. And I have since done over 3,000 public school assemblies in 49 states. Last October, I spoke to 6,000 pre and early teens at a youth convention. And I'm just back from Florida, where I spoke to hundreds of young people about choices, because the bottom line, it's tough to be a young person growing up today. And so I'm speaking for, you know, organizations, I'm speaking at churches, I'm speaking at youth lockups. I want young people to know I have a motto, and that is hope that never surrenders. And I'm an ex-military man, and you never surrender. And I applied that to hope. I would never surrender my hope. And my whole focus in life is to help kids, because so many kids are like committing suicide these days. They need hope.
And well, let me remind people, my guest is Stephen Arrington, and he has written two books, an autobiography, Extreme, and his more recent book, In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant. And when you're invited to speak to kids, they might think, oh, somebody else telling us not to use drugs. But here's a guy who was a Navy frogman. He did research white sharks with the Jacques Cousteau Society, and there you are in a shark cage. I mean, you've got some attention-grabbing facts of your life to share with these young people.
Well, what's amazing for me is 2 years out of prison, I got hired by the Cousteau Society as a chief diver and expedition leader. I didn't speak French. I was in charge of a French ship and a French crew. They thought it was very bizarre. I was still on parole. The prosecutor argued to get me off parole so that I could travel the world with the Cousteaus, and I went on a 5.5-year underwater odyssey of diving whales, dolphins, and great white sharks. And so what I do is I use the whales and the dolphins and the sharks to capture the attention of young minds. And then I weave in true stories of macho FBI and DEA agents, of smugglers, of hitmen, of wacko inmates to teach about the tougher choices in life. But I do it gently. I do it with adventure. I'm a storyteller. And so I speak to kindergartners through university. There's not a person that I can't in some way touch with a message of hope.
You know, another thing, too, is that a young person might say, well, yeah, so I'll get arrested. I'll just go to prison. That's not so bad. But you say, prison is boring.
Yeah, that's what so many young people don't know, is they know that prison is scary, but it's boring. And there's something else. Young people don't want to be told what to do. Well, you get told what to do all the time in prison, and they yell at you and they say, you know, go stand in that corner and put your face to it, and I'll come back in 4 or 5 hours. And they don't come back for maybe 7. Prison, nobody wants to go there. But what I tell young people is, A, don't make mistakes. But if you make a mistake, it doesn't mean you are a mistake. Now, that's not licensed to make mistakes. It's just that, Nancy, do you know that as of 2014, according to the CDC, that the number 2 killer of children 10 to 14 years old is suicide?
Yes.
This is so frightening. And it's also true up to the age of 25. And so I want to talk to young people about hope. I'm not there to do a drug awareness program. It works in. And when I talk about whales and dolphins, people really, you know, the young kids, they want to know about prison. They want to know about the Medellin drug cartel. They want to know what this is like. And that gives me my opportunity to show them it's a world that they never want to get caught up in.
My guest is Stephen Arrington. He recently received a presidential pardon. He waited 9 long years for this pardon. And he received a presidential pardon. And what does that mean in your life now, having gotten this presidential pardon?
Well, I already knew I was forgiven by God. But remember, I had fallen from the rank of heroes. And I put that in perspective earlier in the program. I wanted to be forgiven by my country. I wanted to have a new start. But I also wanted that as a message of hope. You see, when I wrote this book here, I thought that that might sink any pardon I might ever get. But what they looked at, because when I got called by the pardon attorney's office, the attorney who was working on my case got the privilege of calling me. That's what he said. And he knew all about me. And in Fiji, we have a nonprofit foundation where we do free medical and dental. We've now treated over 33,500 patients for free. We've saved hundreds of lives. We brought 6 kids to the United States for life-saving surgery. I mentioned earlier, I've done over 3,000 public school assemblies in 49 states. And so that's what they looked at, is I earned it. That's what President Obama wanted more than anything else. He wanted you to give back to society to earn your presidential pardon. There's only 64 of us who were pardoned in that last 2 days. There were thousands hoping.
Well, since you say we in this Fiji Foundation, I want to give credit to your wife, Cindy, because she is a part of this also, is she not?
Oh, I write about her in the book a lot. And we're lifelong companions, and we have a shared existence. Everything we do together. I couldn't have written this book. There's so much I couldn't do without Cindy. Cindy is the love of my life forever.
You have these opportunities like this foundation in Fiji that it's amazing to me that this opportunity came your way and you took such beautiful advantage of it to create this foundation where you do such good work.
And right now, I was in Florida speaking to hundreds of kids. I was gone for 10 days. I want to be with Cindy. I want to be with my kids. And so
have 3 children, by the way.
I have 3 children. And I want to be here in the North State. So I want to go to churches here. I want to go to public schools. I want to go to private schools. I want to go to organizations. I want to go to corporations. I want to talk. I do wonderful programs with whales and dolphins and sharks. When I talk about jumping in the water 6 feet from a 17.5-foot-long great white shark, we have it on film. And so if I can capture the attention of the kids, then I can work on how they think in life.
For more information about Steve's story, including links to national and local news reports, head to our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.